it was much too interesting to keep track of the time. Okay, so what do I want to talk about? I'm going to talk about linear optics quantum tomography. And in order to give you a teaser of what is the end of my talk to try to compete with email, I'll say that I'm hoping that what we've shown is a way to, if you assume that you're using linear optics, reduce the number of parameters that you need to completely characterize your process exponentially with the number of qubits that you use. So with that sort of advertisement.
What qubits you use, that's what you do anyway.
Well, you'll just have to listen instead of reading your email. I mean that the if you count the number of parameters in the process you're going to use, that'll be related somehow to the number of input qubits, which are photons, because I said it's linear optics, and output qubits. And there'll be some polynomial instead of exponential relationship with the number of qubits. Yes, I'm saying I can do it non-exponentially. Anyone can do it exponentially. Yeah. Okay, but there's some caveats there, and that's not entirely true. But for that, you have to wait till the end. So the second caveat is that this is very much of a workshop kind of talk, in that this grew out of some error correction we were doing for an experiment that we had. And I'll tell you all about that, and about that I'm very confident. And then the second half, this theoretical part, this parameter counting argument, seems promising, but I was really hoping that there could be a conference with a lot of smart theorists where I could ask them if there was really something there, and if it had been done by some Russians in the 1950s, and if I could have their names. So that's where all of you come in. OK, so with that caveat, what did we do in the experiment? OK, so so I work for Prem Kumar at Northwestern now, and I used to work for Paul Kwiat at the University of Illinois. And with Paul, I made entangled states with visible photons in free space. Now I make entangled photons with telecom wavelengths in fiber optics. But pretty much things are similar. And so I'll spend a little bit of time talking about this very large diagram about how we make the inputs to our telecom band CNOT gate, and then about the gate itself. And then I'll spend the rest of the time talking about what I think might be something interesting about analyzing these sorts of processes. OK, so what do? We use an Andrew White-style linear optics CNOT gate, which means it's going to be lossy, and it's going to be measured in post-selection. It's going to work 1/9 of the time. And the thing that you need to operate it is you have to have technically identical input photons, which is polarization, which is the only degree of freedom that this gate is going to operate on, can be the only thing that distinguishes your two input photons. Otherwise, it's not going to work. So how do we get that? Well, we use a process called four-wave mixing, and we send in one pump pulse that is two different colors. And then we go through this Chi-3 process, where instead of with down conversion, you send in one high energy photon, and then you make two low energy photons. We send in two same energy photons, or similar energy photons, and then get out two similar energy photons. This is a degenerate process, so we're sending in two color pumps separated by, let's say, 10 nanometers, so 1545 and 1555 nanometers. And then that's going to go through this circulator. It's going to go straight ahead. And then inside here, we have a lot of fiber, say 300, 500 meters, cooled to liquid nitrogen temperatures. And inside that fiber, this pump pulse is going to make pairs of degenerate photons at their average frequency. So inside here, we're going to make pairs of photons. And because this is a 50-50 beam splitter, we're going to make some of those pairs of photons going in this direction, and some of them going in this direction. And the clockwise pairs of photons will interfere with an equal amplitude of having made pairs of photons in the counterclockwise. And then this is like a Hungle-Mandel beam splitter in reverse. And so then we deterministically separate them. And so you get one photon going out here and one photon going out here. And we get some optics to change their polarization. And voila, we have identical photons of tunable polarization as inputs for our gate. And I'll be more than happy to talk about the experiment and how that actually works with people. But that's the last time I'll talk about the creation, maybe the second last time I'll talk about the experiment. So, Robin?
Do you know when a pair of photons has been created?
Absolutely not. And in fact, the last time I'll talk about the talk is to say that just like in Chi-2, this is a spontaneous process. And so we have some probability in a pulse of making photons, and as long as that probability is fairly, but less than one, much less than one, we have that probability squared of making two pairs, and that probability cubed of making three pairs. That is going to be very important later. Okay, so most of the time, we have nothing or we have pairs of photons coming into this gate. And sometimes we have two pairs of photons. Here's the gate, which I'm not going to go through the math of how it works, except to say that these beam splitters are special, these yellow ones, and they're almost like normal polarizing beam splitters, except that they transmit two-thirds of horizontal light and reflect one-third of horizontal light. And just like a normal PBS, they reflect all vertical light. So these sort of partially polarizing beam splitters. Okay, so I said this gate doesn't always work. The way in which it does not work is two-thirds of the time, you'll get an extra photon coming out this ancillary dump port. And two-thirds of the time, you'll get an extra photon coming out this ancillary dump port. And so one-ninth of the time, we'll get one photon coming out of our target and one photon coming out of our control. And then we're going to say that the gate worked. What this would actually be useful for, well, you know, I can give you some of my funding proposals, but let's just say that we want to measure the CNOT gate with a process tomography. Okay, so that's the name of the game. Nathan.
As I understand it, that's not the only error. One of the errors is the photons come out of the dump port, but another error is that you just get two photons in one of the output modes.
You're absolutely right. Another way that we say this doesn't work is that we get two photons out here or two photons out here. So I may have actually lied about that two-thirds probability here, but I guarantee it only works one-ninth of the time in the ideal case, and far less in practice.
Excuse me.
Yes?
Is this trick with the asymmetry of the polarizing beam splitter similar to the Fock state filter, how it works?
So the Fock state filter I'm not as familiar with. That's where I put in a weak beam splitter, and then I detect one photon some of the time, and then that sort of non-classicalizes a coherent state. I think that this is very different, I'm no expert on. That's a very weak beam splitter that you take off one photon sometimes, and where this is almost a perfectly polarizing beam splitter. So it's not a weak interaction. It's a very strong component. It may be similar in a way that's not obvious to me though.
Did you say that it works much less than 1 minute of time?
That was only making fun of the efficiency of telecommunications band detectors. You can decide how funny that was. Okay, so how did we do? That's one experimental slide, and now we're on to the results, so you can see how much time I'm going to spend on this. So the results are... we have, this is how we measure in the canonical basis, which it means we send in these inputs and we get out these outputs. And so that gives you one way in which your state works, except we want to know how it works in a coherent way. So you have to have superposition. And the best way to measure an entangling gate, we thought, is let's just make some entangled states. So we send in separable states. We try to make entangled states. We do tomography on those, which we're pretty good at. And then we measure how good are those states, characterized by the fidelity and the tangle and linear entropy. And so the answer is, well, really not that good. Definitely entangled, but I would say soundly average in quality. And so we started to think, what causes these errors? Well, most of the literature before this and our initial guess was that it's the overlap of these two modes that's the big problem. Because that's an easy to imagine error, right? You have to have these two very single mode objects come on this beam splitter and hit exactly the same place. And if they go in different places, then they're not interfering and something goes wrong. The problem is, when we model that leads to high elements here, not high elements here. These defied explanation for some time. And so when I showed this in my poster at QCM to experimentalists, they said immediately, why didn't you just take more measurements? The problem was we couldn't take more data because our detectors are so bad that we had to borrow Se-Woo Nam and NIST superconducting photon counters. He has these traveling photon counters in a box that he FedExes all over the world to accumulate hundreds of papers a year. And so we had them for 2 weeks. We took as much data as we could, and then he was gone. And so we were done. So now I was left to try to correct these errors with no more data, no possibility of changing things in the experiment. And so we scratched our head for a little while until we got back to what came out of Robin's very first question, if only he'd been on our team. What about the multiple pairs rates, which we'd measured indirectly, and we looked at it, and we said, oh, that's pretty huge. And I started thinking about this. And I started thinking, well, how do I model multiple pairs? How do I figure out how that works? How is that? What kind of errors? Because I want to know. Multi-pair seems like a good culprit, but is that the type of thing that will really cause these off-diagonal elements to grow? So then I thought, well, what's a CNOT doing? And hopefully you can excuse my crude experimentalist notation, which I assure will get somewhat more applicable towards the end of the talk, and then you guys can tell me what I should have wrote down. So if I write these in sort of creation operators, I have two photons coming in, one of which is in the control state and one is in the target. And what it's supposed to do is it's supposed to flip the second one based on the first one. So you'll see every time the first one's in state two, which is vertical, then the second one flips. This is what I knew it did. And I started writing down creation operators because I want to see how four photons work. And I can't immediately, just from a chi matrix, or I couldn't at least, tell what the errors were going to look like. So I had to go back here. But this really didn't seem very helpful to me. And so I decided, well, if we go, and I think this is supposed to be a bunch of linear optics. And so in principle, if I figure out how it operates on single photons, I should be able to predict how it'll work on two photons or four photons. And this is, in fact, how Jared Milburn and friends initially started talking about this. So I have this. I just count up the optics in here and figure out what they're supposed to do ideally. And then figure out what, for this creation operator single photon input, what are the amplitudes of the different states I can get out from all of those optics. And then it turns out if you multiply this creation operator by this creation operator, I get 9 terms, only one of it which satisfies our post-selection condition. And that is B1, B4, which cancels with B1 minus, or sorry, B4, B1, and the only surviving one is this B3, B1, which is A1, A3, same thing.
We've got A's, B's, 6 different subscripts, circles, squares, and when the triangle showed up, my head exploded.
Right, you noticed.
What's going on here?
So, I wrote this partially because I do better with pictures than with equations, possibly not the best crowd for that explanation. So the light blue circles are all input states. The dark blue squares are all output states that we expect. The purple triangles are the ancillary dump modes. So in practice, we never measure those. But nevertheless, if you want to get the correct behavior for larger states, you have to keep track of exactly what amplitude is here so that in a 4 photons, because remember, I'm going to send in 4 photons because I'm guessing that's where this error came from. But then I want to calculate how many 2-photon coincidences that gives out, which means that if there's any terms which have two photons in the blue boxes, but it then also has some photons in the purple triangles, those get to interfere constructively or destructively and change my count. So I have to keep track of these.
And in fact, your detector can't only measure 2 photons. Yours could, theoretically. You also have some things where, well, you kind of don't know if it was actually 2 photons, you get it quick.
Well, all of our detectors are bucket detectors. So in fact, if we got 2 photons on one side and 1 on the other, we detect 3 photons somehow, but that still counts as a 2 photon detection. So all this you have to pump into the model to see where the errors come from.
A stupid question. If you have 2 ancillary photons in V6, you put 2 in?
Well, that would require me putting 1 in here and 1 in here, or 2 in here or 2 in here, except 3 and 4 are both target photons, and our goal was to just put in 1 photon here and 1 photon here. Though, with the 4 photon input, that could certainly happen, And that's exactly the kind of thing where, that's exactly the reason we try to keep track of these sorts of things. So then I started thinking, well, there's going to be some other rotations in here, and so this isn't exactly going to be what our process is. So I want to do some kind of fitting to estimate the errors, but I don't want to work too hard, because I already know I don't have enough measurements to do a complete tomography, so I don't need to try a complete process tomography, that is. And so I just said, well, what if I assume that this process is mostly pure, and for every input photon, I'm just going to calculate what the coherent amplitude on each of the six possible output terms, the four outputs that I care about and the two outputs that are dump modes. I'm going to fit that to my data, and then I'm going to pump in what I've already measured as the probability of getting two multi-pairs, and then see how my data works. Well, the answer, is that clear approximately what I did to try to estimate these things? Some heads were shaking, so I'm going to go back briefly. Basically, if I put in, to estimate how a C0 is supposed to work, I send in one photon here and one photon here, and I multiply one of these terms by the other term, and then I check my post-selection condition, and I figure out how many counts I got. If I want to send in four photons, I put in two creation operators here, say A1 squared and A3 squared. Now I multiply all the terms together, and now I get a whole bunch of terms, many of which are possible two-photon coincidences. And then I calculate all of those results as well with a lower probability, and then I get my final data set. And then I fit the whole thing. And all of this is to try to figure out if my extra errors that I know I have are plausibly explained by multiple photon counts. Okay. So here's the original results. And so I put this through my model, did the best fit that I could, and then subtracted off all the counts which I then thought were multiple pair counts. And it turns out I get much better results. Except for, in a fairly fishy kind of way, since this is, it's not really a, these aren't, strictly speaking, a process tomography. It's really just an explanation of where the errors in my real tomographies came from, which for an experimentalist is extremely useful for the next time we want
to
do this.
But you needed to fit the probability that you get four photons instead of two. This parameter was not free. You were not.
That's a parameter that we could directly measure. It turns out we didn't know we were measuring at the time, but if we look back to our lab notebooks, we had enough information that we could.
So what was the other parameters? One tenth?
About 10%.
10%. Okay.
Which was about.
So you cannot neglect it.
Definitely cannot neglect it.
So there's no free parameters in this correction. You did a theory calculation of the multi-pair effect and subtract.
No, there's a free parameter because it depends on that we don't have exact which C0 gate we have exactly. So there's sort of a, I don't want to say a unitary transformation, but there's lots of entangling gates equivalent to a C0 that based on exactly what your wave plates were doing. So
this light blue smaller bar is much larger, yes, than all other smaller bars?
So I thought about that light blue bar quite a bit. Really, and it turns out that out of 100 measurements that we took for the whole thing, this is the only one that has a 3 sigma error bar, and so eventually I just had to accept that if you take 100 measurements, you're going to have one 3 sigma error bar, it's a 2.5 sigma error bar, but so that is in fact within error of zero, which tells you something. When the errors are that high, that tells you something about the count rates we were working with. And again, that's because telecom detectors are fairly inefficient. Okay, so this looked like it worked. We explained where our errors came from, at least.
So you worked out that thing that we're seeing is the results that you would have seen had you not had the higher order emissions, or at least what you think you would have seen if you
right.
Didn't have
that's what our model order. Predicts we would have seen. Yes.
Yes.
And the remainder of the inaccuracy we can explain to within error because of the mode overlap. It's not that wasn't a problem at all, it's just that we couldn't explain that much error from the mode overlap. There was this extra problem. Okay, so then the question is, is there something else we can do? Because it seems like if in one instance I can think about processes as how single photons transform, maybe there's an extension to this. Is there something else that I can get out of this? And the assumption that I want to make, the reasoning that I went through to get here is, well, the reason we do linear optics quantum computation, or we try at least, is because there was no strong interaction between single photons. We don't have a box that we can put two photons in and have one affect the other, because they're very weakly interacting. The question is, what if I just make that assumption that nothing I put in the lab, no matter how badly I screw up, is going to cause that kind of an interaction? And then I'm only going to look at processes when I try to reconstruct a process that don't do that. So I'm specifically only going to look at linear optics processes. It seems like there's a lot fewer of those than there are of totally arbitrary processes, which is, I think, in general, how people do process tomography now, because you do an arbitrary two-qubit process, which includes you searching over the probability of having had one photon spontaneously flip the other's bit inside your beam splitter, which, if we find that beam splitter, we're immediately going to start making gates out of it. And so I feel happy making this assumption, because if I'm wrong, then we get that's fantastic. Okay, and so obviously, if that's our assumption, that we're going to have, so this is my assumption, that inside my black box of the process I'm going to think about, I only have transformations of the type that I have one photon in some very, very general mode, and no matter what happens in the black box, it's going to turn into another photon in another very, very general mode, which can be things I'm not measuring or couple to extra degrees of freedom or change color, but it's just going to stay one photon, which means that any number of photons I send into this box, if I have these relations, I'm going to be able to figure out what happens to them. So then I'm going to be able to figure out what I really want to know if it does, which is if it's a 4-qubit or a 6-qubit or whatever gate. If I get these simple rules, then I can get what I really care about, which is how well does my LOQC operation work. I really am considering changing color. That's hard to say. My analogous question would be, when you consider decoherence of a state and you do a state tomography that allows you to measure mixture of a state, do you consider all of the modes that allow that state to be decohered, or do you just try to bound the actual effect of that decoherence? Well, let me show you what I thought. I'll take you to the actual result is really just one slide, but to make it seem more important, I've made it into six. And so you guys can tell me where my thinking went wrong, and we'll see. Maybe it'll be a shorter talk. Okay. So the first thing, I like to do things simple and then get more complicated. So first I'm going to start off by immediately not answering your question at all, Alexei, which is by assuming there's no loss and no decoherence. So in this, if I try to think about what I want to do, I'm just using the model of the C-naught because it's easier to write down. But this, you can imagine having lots of inputs, and then I need lots of outputs. So basically, for every input single creation operator I have, I'm going to parameterize this transformation, and I'm going to say there's some complex amplitude in front of all the output states that I care about. And if there's no loss and there's no coupling to external degree of freedoms, I think this is just a unitary transformation. Could it be that the input is a coherent superposition of outputs? Yes. That probably happened when it was recorrecting whatever it was correcting at the beginning. Yeah, that's wrong. The input is a coherent superposition. Yeah, the output is a coherent superposition of inputs. This is what I care about. Thanks. Okay. Okay. So does this look reasonable for no loss and no decoherence? Okay. So then the question is.
It's linear operation, not necessarily.
Yeah, there are some constraints over those parameters.
That's true. Yes. Okay. In that case, maybe I need to cross out. So this is definitely too general, and I yes, it's definitely too general, and I'm going to try to add all the other cases, and then try to make one big constraint at the end, which makes it legal. But we'll see how well that.
Did you have six outputs in the previous slide?
Those extra two outputs are what I would call loss, because they're in these extra loss modes. Yeah. So that is this. Remember, the other two were purple triangles, so now I'm going to have a purple triangle slide, where. By loss, I mean things that are unmeasured. So, in general, if I have a beam splitter which reflects something off randomly, or if I have my measurement port misaligned slightly, all of those are losses. And so, the photon, even if I assume it's state of photon, is in some very arbitrary superposition of the stuff that I'm measuring and other stuff that went into other modes. And in general, there can be any number of those other modes. So the question I started thinking is, well, I don't want to write down infinite numbers of lost modes. And so then I thought, well, for every one of these input modes that I put in for A1, A2, A3, really there's just one lost mode. It's just horrific to write down. And it can go in lots of different directions, but really it's just one very general lost mode. And then I thought, well, if I have, say, four inputs, then I have four very general lost modes. And I can, if I want to have one basis through which I describe all four of those, since I'm not going to measure them anyway, really I just need four orthonormal states in order to write down all of those four lost modes, because any four states, I think, can be written as a superposition of four orthonormal states, which makes me extend my lines a little. And so now I can write down everything that I actually did in my experiment. And in my experiment that I had, I only planned on having a 5 and 6 term. But really, since this is general and can account for any kind of losses anywhere, these extra four loss terms are in general going to be very ugly. It's just that I think that there should be complex parameters which I can write in front of them, and I can bound the number I need, the number of inputs. Okay, so then the last step is, what do I do with decoherence? Well, I've forgotten a step, in fact. Does that mean that I couldn't have any loss here? It seems that I could talk about, without having those extra purple modes, I could just reduce the size of these betas, and then somehow I'd still be able to calculate how many output photons I have, how many coincidences I have. Because remember, I only needed those purple terms when I recreated the four photon inputs for the two photon outputs, because I needed to see how terms which included those losses constructively and destructively interfered with each other. And so I think that I'm only actually going to need those explicit purple triangle coherences when I want to calculate for a high order input what's going to happen in the lower orders, like how many singles am I going to get out from sending in four photons, or how many two photon coincidences am I going to get out from sending in four photons. So I think the answer is sometimes. And I think the condition when they matter is if I have terms like this, where I've got, let's say I have A dagger H control and A dagger V target. So this is, in the CNOT example, something that I care about. I care about finding out if I get a coincidence like here. But what if, when I expand out these four photon, if I send in four photons as inputs, and then I expand these terms out, I'm going to get terms that all have four creation operators. And what if I have terms that look like A dagger loss, and then I have another term if this loss mode here, let's call this 1 and 2. If this loss mode here is the same loss mode here, then these two terms are going to destroy each other, and I won't see these coincidences in my setup. If this L1 is not the same as this L2, then these incoherently add to each other, and I'm still going to get counts from this term and from this term. But this problem only matters if I'm sending in four photon inputs and then looking at how two photons get it. Because obviously, if I'm looking in four photon coincidence, the presence of any lost terms is going to make all of those, that I'm never going to see them, and so I don't care how they coherently interfere with each other. 2 minutes, okay. Thanks. Okay, let's get going. Okay, and so how do you do decoherence? Basically, you need to couple two external degrees of freedom, which means maybe I had this, so this transformation should be read as, I have an input photon here, which goes to some combination of the outputs. And then you can put the losses in here, too. I just ran it. You can put all eight coupled to, say, this color, plus probabilities of coupling to the same outputs, but this time coupled to a different decoherence mode. And in general, I can have as many of these decoherence modes as you can think of colors. So I can have this can go down very far. Okay, so that sounds hard. So then I start thinking about the chi matrix, except all of you know the chi matrix very well from six talks, so I'm going to skip this slide, except to say that you can get this kind of chi matrix representation when you start with an infinite number of operators and break them into a basis. So let's take those. This looks a lot like what I have here. And so if I think of each, so if I define an arbitrary input vector, it's just a alpha vector over those A's that I had, I have some input rho, then each of these betas that I have looks like a very general Krauss operator. And this is where your question about them being 2 over complete is. Just like a Krauss decomposition can have lots of terms, but it doesn't need to. And the way that I think about simplifying that is breaking each of these into a basis. And then you use the same kind of chi matrix, which I think should still be Hermitian, just like any other chi matrix. And what I think is the end story is I can just do normal process tomography, except now I just think about having 2n input modes, which is the number of single photon input modes, instead of 2 to the n input modes, which is how the number of input modes grows if you think about qubits changing.
The terms there?
Right, so this chi matrix is the has a number of, let's see. So this beta is the inputs times the outputs. That's how big the beta is. This chi has to run over the basis for those betas. So its height and width has to be the number of terms in this beta. So it has to be the inputs times the outputs times the inputs times the outputs.
Which is 16 times 16.
So I think it's 16 times n to the fourth.
The
so this is what I think it comes out to. That you normally have this for processes. This is what you have when you ignore the loss terms. When you include all of those losses, I multiply that together. And then I'll just... So the one thing that I didn't mention but I can talk about later is this ignores feed-forward algorithms, which changes the number of configurations, and then you're allowed to have the number of measurements scale with the number of different configurations due to feed forward, though hopefully there's some simplification there. And then the thing that I really like about this is, in general, we don't like to use singles counts in our tomographies, and they're not that useful, but we don't like to use them because maybe there's stray light getting in. Except in this kind of thing, if you're doing a four qubit process, for example, you can in principle use all of your data, which is the very, very, very few times you actually make four photon inputs, the many times you make four photons going in, you know, one side and not the other, just when you made two photons, just when you made single photons, as long as you know your input state well, this, I intuit, is a lot easier to do in the lab. But this is where there's a big question mark at the end of the talk, and hopefully you guys can tell me what you think. That would be very welcome. Yes. So I think in Bayesian terms, all I'm doing is I'm saying a particularly strong prior. And I'm saying you can't have any processes of the type which would imply a photon-photon interaction. And with that prior, if that eliminates almost all of possible processes, then you should get some improvement. Now this doesn't say that you can make this in a number of measurements of this order. All this says is about parameters, and then I'm guessing that that'll lead to a reduction in the number of measurements. But that's not proven, and in general, that could be hard. Though I would be surprised if that made it exponential.
Two questions. One, I really like the technique. Have you thought
even
about
with the color triangles?
Have you thought about if you could do kind of like a complete device characterization with sort of not being able to access what would traditionally be a complete basis, but using these higher order terms?
So I think that I was really sad that I arrived. On Monday, I had to go home for my first anniversary, so I missed the pretty good tomography talk Tuesday morning, which I was told dealt with if you don't have enough measurements, what can you say about it? I think. If you're asking if you don't have enough measurements even in this, can you make a pretty good guess? I don't know, but I don't see why.
To give you a specific implementation, they're creating integrated photonic circuits now. This kind of Jeremy O'Brien.
Yes, Jeremy O'Brien. I talked to him about this at QCM actually.
Right there, to be able to create the full basis, you have to actually write the operations to create the basis to measure, which is difficult. But maybe you can use these higher order terms to also characterize the.
I certainly think that is certainly my hope, that if you send in that now the probability of making four photons or six photons is a feature, not a bug, and dramatically increases, even with inefficient detectors, the chances of getting some data. Now, it may be that this is really hard computationally, because you have to take your data, if you're doing some maximum likelihood, for example, back to this single photon, then use algebra to calculate how that works with multiple counts, and then use that as your heuristic. I suspect that clever coding can overcome that, but there might be a computational barrier.
This might not be a particular use to you, but it seems to me it might also be interesting to think about squeezing, because it has a similarly restricted Hamiltonian structure that it only linearly transforms the mode operators.
I think that I'm going to advocate squeezing questions, because I've been a single photon guy, and though I enjoy speculating, maybe not at the front of the room.
Yes. So, what, if you're doing linear optics, why do you need to do this quantum mechanically at all? Why not just do classical ellipsometry at all?
You noticed that, did you? Yes. I think that in general, you should be able to do this using only classical input states, as long as at the end you have a.
And therefore, you don't.
The Tolmodyne detector, as long as you have a local oscillator.
Same enormous detectors, you just don't use more of.
So that is absolutely right, and I will definitely write that in some paper at some point. But the reason I don't think I would ever do it if I was building, but actually characterizing a real device for a quantum computer, is that you have to make sure that the classical laser that you're using has exactly the same frequency spectrum. It's in fact made up of all technically identical photons to whatever single photons you're going to send in. And I do not feel confident in my ability to prepare a laser with exactly the same characteristics as whatever single photons I will actually send through the device. And so I think that would be a great quick and dirty characterization of a device, but I wouldn't want to trust it until you actually put through single photons, because the spectrum could be so different. But yes, I think it works.
You could identify all these errors.
As long as you do a Hamiltonian thing, I think you can completely characterize the process classically.
But Joe could create a gate that relies on the Honda.
Yeah, but that's once you've got all the bugs worked out of your.
I mean, you can use the gate with a classical system. This would just be a question of characterization. Well, you have to know the phases between things at the ends, which means either you have to interfere them with each other, or you have to bring a local oscillator around to directly measure the phase of each of the probability terms. Because it doesn't work at all if you don't have complex parameters in front of the things.
You want to ask a question? So do you think that as a general procedure, we can get good theory results by finding a good experimentalist and taking away his detectors after 2 weeks?
I think
I always try to steal something from every lab.
I would say that's an untested conjecture, but there's something there.
On a more serious note, a quick comment, which is your comment about the prior. I think this is the prior that you have here, being a constraint as opposed to a distribution, is one that even a hardcore frequentist would be, you know, happy to use. You're not a scientist. You don't have to be a Bayesian.
No, that's true.
So my question is actually for both you and Rolando. And my question is this, can this be seen as a particular case of what Rolando was talking about earlier?
Yeah.
Are these the linear optics operations and the coherent states that you're working with, are these generalized coherent states?
I think they are from algebra UN.
Yeah.
Where N is the number of photons.
So, yes. Well, in this case, yeah.
Coherent states, my mojo is not that great, so.
Well, there's your connection.
The last question.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
May I ask a few things about your source?
Absolutely.
is it entangled in frequency, for instance?
So that's an excellent question. It's definitely, the answer is yes and no. So this creates a very wide band of correlation. So if I come in with the non-degenerate case, which is I have one strong pump, then I will get a lot of forward mixing where this frequency will correspond to this and this frequency will correspond to this. And so I'll have two pump photons being used, which will create a pair here and a pair here and a pair here and a pair here. In the same way that if I come in with two pumps, which I have now, I can measure in the middle and get degenerate photons. But if I measure, say, here and here, I have a lower efficiency, but I can get frequency entanglement. We operate in what we call the single mode regime, which I think is probably going to be not technically, well, I'm not sure what it means theoretically, but what it means is that, well, I think of it in terms of collection efficiency, that if you measure one photon in here, then you have 100% chance just from frequency filtering constraints to measure its partner, same for here or here. And that really has to do with matching the spectrum of the pump to the spectrum of the signal annihilator, such that everything's transform limited and they easily transform. So the whole broader system is definitely frequency entangled. The piece of it that gets through our frequency filters is not frequency entangled, and we don't have any loss of efficiency because of that. This is very related to invisible sources. People are trying to engineer frequency unentangled states with a vengeance. And we sort of get that for free. We have other problems we have to deal with, but that is something we get almost automatically because of the stuff we have to work with.
Excellent. At this point, we stop. We thank you, Joe, once again.